Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, March 29, 2018. The former SPLM Secretary General says Vivacell has licenses to operate in South Sudan.
Vivacell paid for the license. First of all, this license is issued to the SPLM company, Wawad Securities. There is no way Vivacell can be required to pay for another license.
And residents along the border accuse Sudan of grabbing land in rank.
But our people are not understanding it that way. They take it that now these boundaries, these are the boundaries, and these boundaries are eating into our land, which is not the case.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Subscribers of Vivacell are still not able to make calls across South Sudan after the government shut down the mobile phone company at midnight Tuesday. But the former SPLM Secretary General says Vivacell has a license to operate in South Sudan. Pagana Mum says the government should settle their differences with Vivacell without hurting ordinary South Sudanese who are stuck with Vivacell SIM cards. Amum says the mobile phone company has been a source of income for the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement for some time now.
Vivacell is a company owned by Fotouche Investment, which is the company that invested the money to roll out the company. And the SPLM company known as Wawad Security Limited is an investment arm of the SPLM, and it owns 25%, and that is in lieu of the license which the SPLM acquired during the struggle from the New Sudan authorities. And this license was validated with the CPA, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement that was signed, and therefore Vivacell was issued this license. And this was negotiated in delegations which were shared by Dr. Riek Machar with the participation of people like Michael Mukwege himself. The SPLM Secretariat has been receiving $100,000 from Vivacell, and this is a payment of part of the license as per the agreement that the SPLM will be paid $7.5 million. And indeed, that became an important source to run the affairs of SPLM, and this continue.
You're saying that Vivacell is supposed to have been giving the SPLM party $100,000. Is this per year, per month?
Every month.
So from the time Vivacell was established in 2008, it has been paying SPLM $100,000.
No. Vivacell, when it was established, it was involved in rolling out the network. So it was an intensive period of investing in building the system. It was not making money. It was rather building the network itself. In 2012 is when Vivacell started to pay the SPLM $100,000 a month.
What about this issue of licensing? Because the information minister, Mr. Michael Mukwege, said Vivacell has not been paying for licensing and it has an accumulative fee of around $66 million. I mean, could you tell us the licensing policies that were there?
You know, Vivacell paid for the license. First of all, this license is issued to the SPLM company, Wawad Securities, during the struggle. This license has been validated and confirmed by the government of Sudan as per the agreement. Therefore, the license is issued. The license is what the SPLM used to attract the investor. Absolutely, there is no way VivaCell can be required to pay for another license, because that license was issued during the struggle and it was confirmed by the government of South Sudan, by the government of Sudan. It cannot be made to pay twice.
The government will argue that the agreement was signed with Sudan. Now this is South Sudan. What will you say?
The CPA stipulates very clearly that Sudan, the government of Sudan, will respect all decisions and contracts and engagement that the new Sudan authorities under the SPLM in the liberated areas have entered into. And that is why they confirm and validated the VivaCell license, the Gemtel license, and also they confirm all the companies that have been registered under the new Sudan authorities in Yei.
VivaCell has been suspended from yesterday, and customers are stranded. And you are one of the people who was behind the idea of this investment. How can this situation be resolved?
I believe that it was unnecessary for the government to shut VivaCell down. First of all, they know very well that myself or the FDs do not have any personal interest in it. All these allegations that VivaCell is financing me, is financing that, if they are acting on that while they know the truth, then they are harming the interest of the people, the customers who have been now made stranded, and they have cut their communication, including themselves, including the government itself. There is a way to solve this. If you can allow VivaCell to continue its operation and bring them to shift and comply with whatever regulations that you are requiring of them, it does not need them to be shut down.
That's Pagan Amum, leader of the SPLM, former detainees, and the former Secretary General of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement. He was speaking with me from Addis Ababa earlier today. Last week, Information Minister Michael Makui refused to explain the reasons for shutting down VivaCell. Makui told this program yesterday that VivaCell owes the government $66 million in what he called a cumulative annual license fees. VOA reached out to the management of the mobile phone company for comments, but they declined. South Sudanese in northern Upper Nile State are complaining that Sudan has failed to adhere to its promise of moving its forces 10 kilometers back from the border. The northern Upper Nile State coordinator in Juba says residents of Rang Town fear Sudan will take over the land. Sudanese embassy in Juba declined to comment. Manyang David Mayar reports for VOA from Juba.
In November last year, President Salva Kiir and President Omar al-Bashir agreed to create trade corridors along their shared border to help boost trade between the two nations. On Monday, citizens of northern Upper Nile State took to the streets of Reng to protest against what they see as a land grab by Sudan along the border inside South Sudanese territory. Padiet Kak, the northern Upper Nile State coordinator, says rather than withdrawing the agreed to 10 kilometers into Sudan, the Sudanese army retreated only 7 kilometers. Speaking in Arabic, Kak says residents worry that by the time the border is officially demarcated, South Sudan will have lost 3 kilometers to Sudan.
So people in Ring are saying, why is this trade corridor not taken up from both countries? There should be balance in opening of these corridors, part of South Sudan and also from Sudan.
South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makui, who co-chairs the Joint Border Commission, says there's no cause for alarm because the new border arrangement is only temporary.
But our people are not understanding it that way. They take it that now these border boundaries, these are the boundaries, and these boundaries are eating into our land, which is not the case. When we agree at any other time, we will start the demarcation, and this is where the permanent boundaries will come in. These are temporary arrangements to ease the life of the people along these borders and to ease our relations in terms of business and movement of people.
Makwei says South Sudan and Sudan have not yet begun talks on border demarcation. Military spokesman Lul Rai Kong says the current arrangement along the border is an agreement between two nations, and he too is urging the people of Northern Upper Nile not to panic.
There should be no any concern from our people from Northern Upper Nile that their land is being taken. It is a pure exercise meant to facilitate commercial activities between the two countries, movement of the people in the two countries. We did it. The first leg was in former Northern Bahr El Ghazal. I went to Majangoi. We withdrew 10 kilometers from where we were to south of Majangoi. We went to Erguet. We withdrew 10 kilometers south of Majangoi. The same thing in Keradim. So what is required now for SPLA to do the same in former Unity State in Panakwaj?
Kong says as the two countries' armies withdraw from the borderline, police officers from both countries are taking over the responsibility of manning security in the region. Abdallah Margani Saleh, an advisor at the Sudanese embassy in Juba, declined to comment on whether or not the Sudanese army pulled back only 7 kilometers, but said the Trade Corridors Committee, known as the Joint Political and Security Mechanism, comprised of members from both countries, will address any concerns that pop up regarding the trade corridors between South Sudan and Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Manyang David Mayar in Juba.
An upcoming event dubbed One Journey Festival here in Washington aims to change the narrative of refugees around the world. The organizers say they want to start a conversation about the positive impact refugees can make. As Ayen Dengbio reports, participants say one way to start that conversation is over a cup of coffee.
You can smell the coffee before you see it. Tiana Kacinovic, a volunteer at the One Journey Festival, is a fan of 734 coffee.
So this coffee is fantastic because you can easily drink it throughout the day and it doesn't weigh you down.
But this isn't just any regular cup of coffee. Part of the profit of every bag is set aside to help a refugee in East Africa go to school. The coffee beans themselves are sourced in East Africa by local farmers. So far, the revenue has helped put 5 refugees in East Africa through school. Manyangrith Kerr, the founder of 734 Coffee, says the economic impact is also felt here in the U.S.
The people that put the sticker in are American. The people that build this bag are American. The people that seal this are American. The coffee itself, it has to go through how many people? There are 4 people that make this bag. So that means through the process, we're creating a job just with the bag itself.
Rith, a former refugee from South Sudan, is participating in the upcoming One Journey Festival. Organizers say One Journey is a celebration of unity, resilience, and accomplishment. Ideas that resonate with Nadia Taha, a 734 Coffee volunteer.
I'm from Darfur, and most of my people in Darfur are refugees. And my friend, he's been in Darfur, and he helped my people. And I know this coffee will be impact for refugees in the refugees camp.
The One Journey Festival is all about changing the conversation about refugees worldwide. Taha tells me it's also about celebrating their contributions.
And every people here, they're buying the coffee. That means he's bringing income to U.S. and all over the world. And this money goes back home, and people, they can go to school with the money. And refugees, he's giving jobs. You know, there is a lack of youth jobs. And he's giving jobs to the youth.
There's more than 65 million refugees worldwide. The data on the economic impact on local economies is limited. But Taha says even a little goes a long way.
So if you employ 10 people, that's enough. You know, we are helping. Everyone is doing the same we do. The global will change. You know, the world will be changed.
Change is an enormous goal, but it's exactly what organizers hope to achieve. Ayen Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the UN mission in South Sudan leads a safety campaign for border riders. Find out why when we come back.
do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what makes you proud of yourself?
Because I'm healthy and certainly alive. Very many people have not been able to make it to my age, because at this age of mine, I'm making 37 in October 21st. Therefore, I'm proud of that.
Managing life, trying to handle challenges and issues, and also helping other people out.
Now I'm proud because I'm at campus. I'm doing procurement and logistics management. I think that's what makes me proud. At my age, being at university, doing such a course, I'm 19 years old.
I feel proud of myself when I'm considered and respected by others. In other words, it is because of my dignity.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The United Nations Mission in South Sudan and the South Sudan Motorcycle Association yesterday launched a campaign aimed at what they call empowering and providing additional protection to border drivers. Wake Simon Wudu has the story for VOA from Juba.
Hundreds of Badabada drivers from around the city took part in yesterday's Right for Peace, Right for Safety campaign. Clad in white helmets and green and red reflective jackets, the Badabada riders were accompanied by traffic and police officers on their right around the capital. David Sierra, the special representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan, led the procession of motorcycle riders.
We recognize these guys as, and guys and girls now, and women as well, and border brothers, as being a really important part of the economy of South Sudan. People rely on them very, very heavily. And if we can help to make the ride more safe, that's good for the border boaters who might have an accident and then be out of commission and not be able to work, as well as their passengers.
UNIMIS distributed 1,500 helmets and the same number of reflective jackets to the border riders to protect them as they take passengers to their destination on the busy streets of Juba day and night. Vonnie Kennedy says he has been a border driver for the past 3 years. Kennedy says he makes enough money to buy food and pay his tuition fees at Kampala International University, where he is a second-year student of computer science and information technology. He says he cannot afford to buy a helmet, which costs at least 5,000 South Sudanese pounds or about $21. He says he appreciates the free helmets and vests, but he also views the procession as a message to South Sudan's politicians.
So we doing it like this, we go out there marching like this. Most of the people will also know that we are really looking for peace. Because like these days now, we're having a lot of problem. Even riding a bike is a problem. Sometimes if you ride at around 8 there, people just attack you. You don't know where these people are coming from. So we need peace. If peace comes, we'll be very, very happy, and we'll even work normally.
26-year-old Taban Michael says he has been driving a motorbike taxi for the past 6 years. Michael says he acquired a bachelor's degree in banking and finance from Uganda's Ngulu University 3 years ago, but he says he finds operating a motorbike taxi more profitable than some of the white-collar jobs in South Sudan. He says he earns at least 3,000 South Sudanese pounds per day, totaling about $400 per month.
I'm very happy, very happy. Getting helmet and jacket, it helped me to protect myself. When I fall down or I got an accident, can easily protect me from hitting my head. And a reflector can help me to be identified during night when I'm riding a border.
Abraham Jok, chairman of the South Sudan Border Association, says at least 7,000 youth are border drivers who make enough money to support their families. He says yesterday's campaign also sent a political message.
South Sudan is in crisis, and people are yearning for peace. So the border is trying to advocate to the public that we need peace so that we'll be able to ride on our road with peace. Ride for safety means when you have jacket and by chance you make an accident, the jacket will help you. I mean, the helmet will help you. It will protect your brain from brain damage in case should you make an accident.
Speaking in Arabic, Colonel Jeremiah McKerney, who represented the traffic police department at the event, encouraged border border riders to use the helmets and reflective jackets every day.
You should not leave your helmets and reflective jackets at home.
Jock says UNMISS spent about $150,000 on the safe driving border border campaign. Most passengers in Juba do not wear helmets. The campaign did not address that safety issue. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Kenya's High Court has fined three top government officials $2,000 each for defying court orders, including an order to release detained opposition leader Miguna Miguna. The sentencing reflects a months-long tug of war between the executive branch and the judiciary in the wake of last year's contentious presidential election. Rahel Ombur has the latest for VOA from Nairobi.
Kenyan Interior Minister Fred Matiang'i, Inspector General of Police Joseph Boynet, and the head of immigration Gordon Kihalangwa were again no-shows in court Thursday.
Each of the first, second, and third respondents are hereby penalized to pay a fine of Kenya shillings 200,000 personally. The said sum will be deducted directly from their next month's salaries.
Judge George Odunga issued the sentence. On Wednesday, the judge held the three officials in contempt of court for defying an order to immediately release opposition leader Miguna Miguna, who had been detained at the airport since Monday and denied entry to Kenya.
In this case, it's clear that the respondents are the ones in charge of security in this country. They are, in effect, in charge of execution of warrants of arrest. They have clearly shown that they have no respect for the rule of law and will not comply with the orders of this court. To my mind, even if the citizens were to arrest them, they'll still be placed at the disposal of their juniors. I do not see how any of their juniors will execute the warrants against them.
The Interior Ministry spokesman declined to comment on the sentencing when reached by VOA. Kenyans woke up Thursday morning to learn that Miguna had been deported for a second time during the night, this time to Dubai. A human rights lawyer and assistant to Miguna told VOA's Daybreak Africa that Miguna had been forcibly deported under sedation. Lawyers in Nairobi wore yellow ribbons Thursday in protest.
The legal fraternity and the whole country has become increasingly concerned with states' blatant disregard of lawful court orders as witnessed over the last couple of months. There can be no justification for disobedience of court orders by any party.
Harriet Chigai, the vice president of the Law Society of Kenya, spoke alongside leaders of the Kenya National Human Rights Commission at a joint press conference Thursday. Officials have defied several court orders this year relating to both the previous arrest and deportation of Miguna in February and a media blackout over the opposition swearing in of Raila Odinga as the so-called People's President in January. Miguna's lawyer Nelson Harvey says the government has set a dangerous precedent.
The biggest beneficiary of the due process is the government. So when the government disobeys court orders, they're setting a very bad precedent, because in future, nobody else will have any compulsion to obey a court order.
The matter is expected to return before the High Court on April 6th. Setting the date for the hearing, Judge Odunga said his order from earlier this week that the state produce Miguna in court is still valid. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
We could see the world's first 100 million population city by the end of this century. That is the conclusion of new research into the speed of urbanization in many fast-growing countries in Africa and Asia, which suggests even smaller cities could balloon into huge metropolis in the coming decades. Henry Ridgewell has more.
By the end of the century, the world's population is forecast to reach up to 14 billion. 80% of those people will be living in cities, according to the new research from the Ontario Institute of Technology. Co-author Professor Daniel Hornweg spoke to VOA via Skype.
We're now seeing the urbanization wave heading through China. That's toward the latter part of its urbanization, and now it's headed for India. And then we'll see it culminate in the big cities of sub-Saharan Africa.
That could mean the first 100 million population city. And the top candidate is Lagos, Nigeria. Today, its population is 20 million, not the largest, as that accolade belongs to Tokyo, with about 38 million people, but one of the fastest growing. In two generations, Lagos has grown 100-fold. By 2100, it is projected to be home to more people than the entire state of California.
Well, Lagos, Dar es Salaam, Kinshasa, these are the cities that are looking at 4 to 5-fold increases in population. By the end of the century, the lion's share of large cities will be, you know, the top 20, if you will. Most of those will be in Africa.
Lagos sprawls across 1,000 square kilometres, an urban jungle of skyscrapers, shanty towns and everything in between. Its population grows by 900 people per day. The poorest residents, often migrant communities, live in slums by the lagoon. Amnesty International has warned of ruthless forced evictions to make way for new developments, which have left more than 30,000 people homeless and 11 dead. Oladipupo Avyomie lives in the Ilaje Bariga shantytown.
The threat of being evicted, the threat of being chased away overnight, has grabbed people to the extent that they cannot even work, operate or do anything in this area.
Across Africa, the median age is under 20 and the fertility rate is 4.4 births per woman. Even small cities are forecast to balloon in size. Niamey in Niger could grow from less than 1 million today to 46 million by the end of the century. Blantyre in Malawi from 1 to 40 million. Asia too will witness huge urban growth, with Kabul in Afghanistan projected to hit 50 million people. Hornweg says despite the associated problems of slums, poor sanitation and pollution, increasing urbanisation can be a good thing.
Cities, by their nature, because of our more compact lifestyle, can provide a quality of life higher than anywhere else with less energy per unit of GDP. So cities actually provide a really important opportunity. We won't get to global sustainability without big cities.
Many cities in the West are predicted to plateau or decline in size. By the end of the century, only 14 of the biggest 100 are forecast to be in North America or Europe. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
That's piece by Henry Ridgewell from London brings us to the end of our show for these stars. They will now leave you with the song As-Salam Wasal by a group from Blue Nile State in Sudan. We have been listening to a group from Blue Nile State with that song, As-Salam Wasal. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Would like to know what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Our Facebook name is South Sudan in Focus. Thanks for allowing us into your homes and vehicles. We invite you to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Salam wa salam.